Hello, folks. Welcome to First Thursday, the monthly podcast from the Labor Relations Information System. My name is Will Aitchison. I'll be your host for the next 45 minutes or so while we talk over recent developments in the public safety workplace. And because it's on everybody's mind, I want to start with a few observations about the virus in the public safety workplace. First, on an optimistic note, as I'm recording this, it appears we have three vaccines that will be ready to go within a month or a month and a half or so. There's the Pfizer vaccine, of course, which requires super refrigeration, which may be a little bit difficult to distribute. But the other two will be a little bit easier to distribute and can have pretty wide penetration into the community. It seems very likely that public safety officers are going to be at the top of the priority list for receiving the vaccine. The federal government announced yesterday that it was going to leave that issue of prioritization up to individual states. And from what I've seen from governors and state health authorities, they're putting public safety employees, police, fire, corrections, right up at the top of the list, along with medical caregivers and the like. So it looks like finally our trajectory is going in a positive direction. Hopefully by next spring, we will see some definite movement towards normality. The second thing is, I just wanted to stress, and if you can stress to your employees and your members the same thing, we do have a little bit of a light at the end of the tunnel here. Now is not the time to let down our guard. I was really struck by two newspaper articles I read within the last couple of weeks. The first was an article from an Arizona newspaper that cited the Officer Down website, which is a website that keeps track of line-of-duty deaths by law enforcement officers. And what the article said and what the website says is, you know what's the leading cause of death of law enforcement officers from on-the-job illnesses or injuries right now? It's not vehicular accidents. It's not being the victims of the use of deadly force by a suspect. It's COVID-19. The other article that I saw that was really striking concerned the Chicago Police Department. And the article was about frustration on the part of the mayor of Chicago, her name's Lori Lightfoot, about the fact that Chicago police officers, some of them, are apparently refusing to comply with direct orders from the department to wear masks. As of the date of the article, which is a couple weeks old, 10% of the department's officers had tested positive for coronavirus. There had been an increase in 293 confirmed cases between October 1 and November 1. Goodness knows what it's been since November 1. And three officers have died from the virus. So, this is serious. I read an article in the same week about the Kansas City Fire Department, which has, with a much smaller workforce, lost three firefighters to COVID-19. So let's everybody stay vigilant because we are hopefully seeing the end of the virus in sight. Months away, but in sight. The last thing I wanted to say about the virus is I keep getting the same question from people around the country. And the question is, can I or can my employees or can my members refuse to take the vaccine when the vaccine comes out? And we don't have a lot of law in that area. There's a little bit, but certainly nothing that is pertinent to COVID-19 and certainly nothing that involved a vaccine that was dealing with a pandemic. But here's what I think the rules are going to be from the little bit of law that we do have. First of all, you always start these questions by asking whether or not an employer will have to bargain over a decision. Will an employer have to bargain over a decision to force employees to take a vaccine against COVID? And I think the answer is likely yes, where you have collective bargaining. And the reason I say that is there's a lot of issues concerning an employee's personal privacy, the privacy of their body, if you will, that an employer has to bargain about. For example, a change in a tattoo policy or a change in a grooming code. And if those sorts of things are negotiable, certainly compelling an employee to take a vaccine is likely to be negotiable. But let's put aside the bargaining obligation for a moment. Let's assume the employer has either satisfied its obligation to bargain or that there is no obligation to bargain. Do employees have any personal rights, not union-held rights now, but personal rights to say, I don't want to take a vaccine if the employer is ordering them to do so? And the answer to that question, I think, is going to be yes, but they're very limited rights. And those rights will stem from the employee's presence in a protected class under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act or some other analogous protected class. So you could, for example, have an employee who has a particular medical condition where the taking of the vaccine might jeopardize their health. That would put them in a protected class under the Americans with Disabilities Act. More likely, the claim that you are going to see is that an employee is in a protected class by virtue of their religion, a religion that forbids the taking of a vaccine. And those are the employees who are likely to have some ability, and it's, yes, you'll hear me say, I think it's going to be a limited ability, to say no to a vaccine. So, why do I think there are going to be limitations on the ability of the employee to say no? Simply because you're in a protected class doesn't mean that the case is over. An employer can reasonably accommodate someone's presence in a protected class. So you can reasonably accommodate somebody's disability, or you can reasonably accommodate somebody's religious preferences if you are an employer and you will have met your obligations under federal law. And in our newsletter, our monthly newsletter, which by the way, if you're not subscribing to, you should be because you get premium podcasts with our monthly newsletter. So in an addition earlier this year in our monthly newsletter, I summarized a decision from the Federal Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals involving a firefighter who was refusing vaccines on the grounds that they conflicted with his religious beliefs. This vaccine was the Tdap vaccine, which is an acronym for tetanus, diphtheria, and pertussis. And this firefighter was given two options by the employer. And option one was, okay, we'll accommodate you. We will assign you to the position of code enforcement officer, and you'll have the same pay and benefits. Of course, you may not get the overtime you might get as a line firefighter, but you'll have the same pay and benefits as a code enforcement officer, and you won't have to take the vaccine. Option number two is you can stay in your current position as a line firefighter, but you have to agree to wear PPE, including a respirator, at all times while on duty, submit to testing for possible diseases when your health condition justifies it, and keep a log of your temperature. So there are your choices. Door number one, code enforcement officer. Door number two, stay in your current job. You may get the overtime, but you're going to have to wear a respirator and submit to testing. The firefighter's answer was, no, I want door number three. And door number three means I don't have to wear a mask and I can stay in my current position. The employer fired the firefighter and the firefighter sued. claiming religious discrimination under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. And this makes its way to the Federal Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. And the Court of Appeals said, look, an employer's obligation to reasonably accommodate somebody's religion or disability, that obligation is to come up with a reasonable alternative. It is not to come up with an alternative that the employee finds satisfactory. If the employer's proposed reasonable accommodation or accommodation is reasonable, then the employer has met its obligation under the law and the employee cannot refuse the accommodation without possible job consequences. Here, there's a clear, reasonable accommodation that the city offered. A non-line assignment or stay in your line assignment and wear a respirator. That's all the city needed to do was to come up with a reasonable accommodation. And that means employee, firefighter, you have lost your job for refusing to take the vaccine. I think you're going to see that same sort of analysis with respect to the COVID vaccine. And if anything, because of the fact that we now have 200,000 people a day being infected by this virus, if anything, I think you're going to see more deference to employers with COVID than you would see with Tdap or there's some other cases that involve a flu vaccine. At any rate, no cases yet, but you just wait. They will come. I next want to go up to Washington State and talk about an issue that arises in a wide variety of different contexts. And the issue is, what happens when you have something that is mandatory for bargaining? So the employer has an obligation to bargain over whatever this is, and it could be a lot of different things. And yet, there is a state statute that seems to give the employer the right to act unilaterally in the area. What wins, the bargaining obligation or the state statute? Now, this is a long-running case that I'm going to be talking about, and I have earlier done a short version of what I'm about to say for the podcast, but now this case has reached the Washington Court of Appeals, and I think it has some very important principles in it. So what's the case about? It involves 85 corrections officers who work for Benton County in Washington. That's a county in eastern Washington. The Benton County auditor discovers that there's an accounting software coding error. And what that coding error has produced has been overpayments to employees. I know, it's never happened before, right? And it'll never happen again. Well, the auditor sends the sheriff a letter saying, well, we've made this error. There is this state statute out there that allows us to unilaterally recoup the overpayments on a scheduled basis. And so that's what I intend to do, is just simply start making deductions from the employees' checks until we get all our money back. And in fact, she was right. The auditor was right. There is a Washington statute that allows employers to recoup overpayments on a scheduled basis. So the sheriff, when the sheriff gets this this memo from the auditor, the sheriff turns around and sends a letter to all of its employees. And this letter has the charming title, Notice, Wage Overpayment Repayment Demand. How'd you like to be an employee and get a letter that is titled like that? Someone needs to work on writing headlines in Benton County. So what the letter tells the employee is, look, you've been overpaid. Here's how you were overpaid. And you get three options. We will deduct the full overpayment amount from your next paycheck. We will deduct an amount that you specify from future paychecks, or we will deduct an amount that will not exceed 5% of the employee's disposable earnings in any pay period. That's basically the sort of structure that the state statute allows. What the letter did not say was, here's how you can contest either the overpayment or how we calculated it. Well, after a while, this information trickles down to Teamsters Local 839, which represents the corrections officers. County didn't give notice to the union of this. Local 839 does what you might expect. It demands to bargain over the recoupment and how the recoupment was to be accomplished. Local 839 actually didn't contest the fact that the employees owed the money, but it wanted to talk about how the employees would be allowed to pay back the money. I know some unions that would say, hey, your mistake. We're really sorry about that, but we're not going to pay it back. But Local 839 was not that type of union and said, we just want to talk about the method and the calculations. What did the county do when it got Local 839's letter? It failed to respond to the letter, and within a few days began unilaterally deducting money from employees' wages and accrued leave. Well, if you're going to act like this as an employer, you know what you're going to get, right? An unfair labor practice complaint. Local 839 actually filed two. One was what you can think of as a direct dealing unfair labor practice, and that is where the employer tries to negotiate directly with employees rather than with the union about a mandatory subject of bargaining. So the direct dealing here would be sending the letter to all the employees saying you have these options. That's negotiating, right? And the second unfair labor practice, which I think is the more important one, is that the county violated its bargaining obligation by unilaterally implementing the recoupments. And this is the issue that ends up before the Washington Court of Appeals. What wins? The state statute that allows unilateral recoupments or the bargaining obligation? And the Court of Appeals says the bargaining obligation prevails because of the way our state bargaining statute is written. And the way Washington's Public Employees Collective Bargaining Act, PECBA as it's called in Washington, the way Washington's PECBA is written is that it supersedes any conflicting laws. Let me read you the sentence from PECBA. If any provision of this chapter conflicts with any other statute, ordinance, rule, or regulation of any public employer, the provisions of this chapter control. So the Washington Court of Appeals looks at that sentence and says, look, if the legislature wanted to make the wage overpayment recoupment statutes control over the bargaining law, could have done so. In fact, it did exactly the opposite. And as the court puts it, quote, we therefore presume the legislature knew the bargaining law would control over the wage overpayment statutes without an express intention otherwise. The bargaining law must control over other legislation. And that is the way that these cases come down when you see them decided in various contexts across the country. There are other contexts, of course. It might be a disciplinary context where there is a state law that impacts discipline. It might be a promotional case. There could be a change in a state wage and hour law. And in all of these sorts of circumstances, it's going to come down to whether the state collective bargaining law has some sort of language that gives the collective bargaining law primacy over conflicting laws. And in Washington, that sentence gave the primacy. Hence, unfair labor practice on the part of the county from doing what it looked like the county could do under the wage overpayment recoupment law. Next, I want to head over to Illinois to answer a question that I'm sure has been on all of your minds. How could a roadside beef involving a dispatcher end up tickling important principles about qualified immunity and the Second Amendment? Well, thanks to Kelly Calderon, we have an answer to that question. Calderon is a dispatcher with the City of Chicago's Office of Emergency Management and Communications. And in 2017, she was off duty, driving her car. And while she was idling alongside Calderon at a red light, another motorist, Celine Garcia, threw a drink into Calderon's vehicle and then pulled to the side of the road. Intriguingly, the court's opinion does not tell us what occurred in the seconds before all of that happened, but we may well have an instance of perceived bad driving on the part of Calderon. So Calderon then follows Garcia off the side of the road and stops right behind Garcia's car. The two of them get out of their cars and they argue. After a minute or so, Garcia has had enough. She returns to her vehicle. She tries to drive away. Calderon then stands in front of Garcia's car, barring any exit. I don't think the way I want to stop a car from driving away is by putting my body in front of it. But this may be a Chicago sort of thing. Who knows? When Garcia tries to drive around Calderon, Calderon moves to stop her. Garcia then gets out of her car. She pushes Calderon several times and eventually grabs Calderon by the hair and throws her to the ground. What does Calderon do? She takes out her handgun and shoots Garcia. Calderon was legally permitted to carry the handgun on her person. Of course, you then get a police response to the scene. Calderon is arrested. As for Garcia, the bullet lacerated several of her vital organs, including her heart. Doctors removed portions of Garcia's liver, pancreas, and gallbladder, as well as one kidney. And she's hospitalized for several months. And she still has the bullet lodged near her spine. Because the doctors decided it was too dangerous to remove. An Illinois grand jury indicts Calderon for attempted murder. And after the initiation of Calderon's criminal case, the city administratively charges her with violation of its rules and eventually terminates her. Next up is the bench trial on the attempted murder charges, and the trial judge acquits Calderon on the basis of self-defense. The city then reinstates Calderon, and you would think that all is well, but it's not, because Calderon then sues the city in federal court, alleging that her termination deprived her of her Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms. And this case ends up in front of the federal Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. And the court finds that the doctrine of qualified immunity bars Calderon's claims. We've all now heard about the doctrine of qualified immunity and how it's a big issue in the police reform discussions. What qualified immunity is a judge-made doctrine. It was created by the U.S. Supreme Court over 100 years ago. And what it does is to provide public officials immunity from civil liability for conduct that does not violate clearly established statutory or constitutional rights that a reasonable person would have known about. And so the Seventh Circuit says, well, you know, let's not even get to the merits of this case, let's just look at qualified immunity. Would a reasonable public servant have thought, public servant as in Calderon supervisors, would they have thought that the Second Amendment not only protects the right to keep and bear arms, but also the right to use a firearm? Because after all, Calderon wasn't disciplined for having a firearm. She was disciplined for using it. And here's what the court ends up saying about that whole issue. The parties, and I'm quoting, the parties have not provided, nor have we located, a single decision considering the circumstances in which discharging a firearm constitutes self-defense for purposes of the Second Amendment. Lacking any discernible standard, the scope of the right remains a matter of First Amendment. Qualified immunity is particularly appropriate in this situation. So what the court ends up saying is, look, you know, that court question about how far does the Second Amendment go? Does it protect use of a firearm? We can't even find any cases on that. And if we can't find any cases, it is clear that Calderon supervisors were not acting in derogation of a clearly established statutory or constitutional right. This is not a right that, quoting again, every reasonable official would have understood. Thus, Calderon's lawsuit is dismissed. I want to stay in Illinois and talk about another question you may have on your mind, which is, if I'm terminated and my union takes my case to arbitration and I lose, can I sue the union's lawyer? This, too, is a longstanding case that I have alluded to briefly in a prior podcast, but we now have a decision from the Illinois Supreme Court on the issue. So let's set the stage here for what the court ends up deciding. The officer, this involves a police officer, his name is Russell Zander of the village of Fox Lake. He's terminated for a variety of different forms of on-the-job misconduct. Zander's labor organization is the Fraternal Order of Police, and the FOP has a staff of in-house counsel, and the FOP assigned one of them, he's an experienced lawyer, his name is Roy Carlson, to represent Zander. Now, under Illinois law, a terminated officer can choose between having binding arbitration, if that's available under a union contract, or a hearing before a local board of fire and police commissioners to challenge discipline, to challenge, in particular, in Zander's case, his discharge. Zander sits down with Carlson and says, the two of them have a discussion, which way should we go, fire and police commission, or should we go to arbitration? Carlson recommends arbitration. Zander says, okay, we're going to arbitration. There's a two-day hearing, and the arbitrator upholds the city's decision or the village's decision to terminate Zander. Zander, now not happy at all, sues Carlson and the FOP for damages. And the question is the main question the court has to decide is, are there any set of circumstances under which Carlson could be liable to Zander? Let's assume Carlson acted completely negligently. There's no evidence that he did, by the way, but let's assume that he did. Could Carlson be liable to Zander? The court starts off not by looking at Illinois state law, but instead by looking at federal law. A federal statute that, when it was created, was known as the Taft-Hartley Act. Sometimes it's referred to as the Labor Management Relations Act. And the LMRA, Taft-Hartley Act, has a section that says, and I'm going to quote a portion of a sentence, that judgments against a labor organization, quote, shall be enforceable only against the organization as an entity and shall not be enforceable against any individual member or his assets. And the court says that federal courts, looking at the LMRA for many, many years, have consistently interpreted this language to mean that individual union members, union agents, union representatives are not personally liable for any civil liability that the organization may have for actions that the individuals undertook on behalf of the union. Parenthetically, if you are a union and you have ever investigated insurance for breach of duty of fair representation, you'll see that the insurance company most likely will offer you a rider, and the rider will insure the individual officers of the union from liability in addition to the labor organization itself. The main policy covers the labor organization, the rider, just the individual officers. You'll notice that that insurance is breathtakingly cheap. I think the last time I saw a quote on DFR insurance, it was about $18,000 a year for the organization to be insured. And the rider for individual union officers was $250. Why is it so cheap? Because of what I've just told you about the LMRA. And that is that individual officers don't have any liability under the LMRA because it's only the union that has the obligation to the individual member. So this insurance that looks incredibly cheap at $250 or whatever the quote might be, they're actually insuring against nothing. They're insuring against a risk that doesn't exist. It's just extra money that you're paying an insurance company. Okay, back to the case. So the court says that's federal law, but we all know that federal law doesn't apply to state and local governmental bodies, at least federal labor laws do not. And so the village of Fox Lake, says the court, that's a political subdivision of the state of Illinois, it's controlled by the local collective bargaining statute. And so what we have to decide is whether under our state bargaining laws, we should apply the same principles that you would see under federal statutes. And Zander says, there's a reason you should do so. And here's how the court characterizes Zander's argument. In Zander's view, claims based on legal malpractice present a special case. He contends that this court's, the Supreme Court of Illinois, rules of professional conduct create a higher standard of care, and that the state's interest in protecting the public from legal malpractice should transcend federal labor law. And the court says, not buying it, Zander. And I'm quoting again, immunizing union lawyers from personal liability for actions taken on behalf of the union doesn't absolve them of all of their professional obligations. They have obligations under our rules of professional conduct, and they could be subject to disciplinary action up to and including disbarment. Quote, the conflict Zander seeks to create is therefore a false one. The court goes on to say, but you know what the real big problem here is? Is that Carlson didn't represent Zander. Carlson's client was the union. It was not Zander individually. Carlson worked for the union. He appeared in the arbitration on behalf of the union, albeit he was protecting the union's rights under the collective bargaining agreement, of which Zander was a derivative beneficiary, but he was representing, Carlson was representing the union. Carlson met frequently with the FOP concerning Zander's case. He shared information with the union. He had business and strategy discussions about the case. Carlson, says the court, operated under FOP's control, and Zander had no input into the union's decision to appoint Carlson and no right to decide how Carlson was going to put on that state, on that case. And the court says, we've looked around the country. We've seen how other state labor boards around the country have addressed this issue. And we think that the law is quite consistent around the country. And that law is that an attorney who performs services on behalf of a union may not be held liable in malpractice to union members pursuing grievances, where the services performed by the attorney were part of the collective bargaining process. Federal courts have held that, state courts have held that, and we hold that as well. Finally, Zander comes up with another theory. It's actually not a bad theory. Zander says, look, it may well be that that Carlson was representing the FOP and that was his client. However, I am a third-party beneficiary of the relationship between Carlson and the FOP. And there is a whole line of contract law that's out there under which people who meet the standards for being third-party beneficiaries, and it's a very, very limited category of people who are third-party beneficiaries, where they can actually bring a lawsuit even though they're not party to the contract. And Zander is saying, look, I'm one of those third-party beneficiaries. And the court is having none of it. The court says, quote, applying third-party beneficiary principles to override the immunity that would otherwise protect a union attorney would shift liability for a union's representation of its members from the union to the union's agent, the very thing the law says must not be done. So, bottom line, union member does not have the right to sue a union lawyer for malpractice in the way an arbitration is presented. I want to end this podcast with a discussion of a fascinating case that comes to us out of New York involving pregnant employees and light duty work. And there's been a lot of litigation in this area in various places over the years. And this court takes a new tack on the issue. And actually, when I was reading the opinion, I've got to tell you, my first reaction was the court was wrong. And then the more I thought about it, the more I ended up thinking the court may well be right. And in any case, what I think is irrelevant. They're the guys and gals wearing black robes, not me. So anyway, what does this case involve? It involves a corrections officer. Her name is Anne Marie Legg. And she's a corrections officer at the Ulster County Jail in New York. And she was pregnant, and she requested the opportunity to work light duty. The county denied her request and denied it on the basis of a policy that only allows employees injured on the job to get light duty assignments. Nobody else gets light duty assignments under this policy except those who have on-the-job injuries. The county responded to Legg's request by giving her two options. First, she could work in full duty in positions that did require regular contact with inmates. Or secondly, she could simply go on leave, exhaust her accrued leave, and if need be, file for New York State disability benefits. Legg sues the county in federal court. And the case bounces from the trial court up to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, back down to the trial court, and 11 years later, we are back at the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. And the court describes at some length the rights, and really the lack of rights, of pregnant employees to light duty work. So the court starts off, I think, in a very non-controversial way. The court starts off by saying Title VII protects pregnant employees, and clearly does. 1978, Congress passed the Pregnancy Disability Act, the PDA, which became part of Title VII, that forbids employers from discriminating against pregnant employees. And the court says, yeah, that act applies. But it's important to consider that the act does not do something. And what it does not do is it doesn't impose on employers an affirmative obligation to provide accommodations to pregnant employees that they don't provide to similarly situated employees. Now, this is going to become critical. This notion that in the only obligation with respect to reasonable accommodation, or the main obligation with respect to reasonable accommodation, is that if an employer provides an accommodation to a non-pregnant employee, an accommodation like light duty, for example, who is similarly situated to the pregnant employee, then it will be held to violate Title VII. But if the employees aren't similarly situated, no obligation to offer the accommodation. So here's the way the court analyzes this. The court says a plaintiff who is pursuing a disparate impact, that's a type of discrimination claim under the act, must demonstrate that some pregnant women are similar in their ability or inability to work to non-pregnant employees who receive the accommodations. Quote, simply proving that all pregnant women will automatically be denied accommodations is insufficient because it is tantamount to requesting that the court assume pregnant women are inherently incapable of working full duty. Okay, pause, full stop here. What's the court saying? The court's saying, look, the comparators you're pointing to, Ms. Legg, the comparators you're pointing to are people who have had on-the-job injuries. They are incapable of working full duty. So those are the comparators. In order for them to be true comparators, you would have to establish that pregnant employees are incapable of working full duty. Then you'd have similarly situated employees. And the court says you just simply don't have that here because you have no evidence in this case that pregnant employees can't perform the full range of job duties. Now, would it be possible to come up with such evidence? Maybe in the later term of a pregnancy, maybe, but there's no evidence of that in this case. And let me read you the couple of sentences with which the court closes its opinion. Quote, we are sympathetic to the difficult choice that Legg faced between working full duty in a hazardous environment and losing substantial income by going on leave and receiving only disability benefits. We point out that the county's policy may be vulnerable to a disparate impact claim upon a sufficient evidentiary showing of pregnant officers' inability to perform full duty work. But that isn't the record we have before us here, says the court. There's no showing that pregnant employees couldn't do the full range of job responsibilities. Hence, they're not similarly situated to the light-duty employees with on-the-job injuries who could not do the full job responsibilities. Therefore, no violation of the Pregnancy Discrimination Act. As I said, I had a hard time with that opinion the first time I read it. It's kind of a conceptually very complicated and odd way to get at the issue. But in the end, I'm thinking the court is probably right. I'm thinking the comparators would have to be people who were put on light duty who could perform the full range of job duties. And of course, who would those people ever be? They are not the people for whom light duty policies are made. This essentially says that pregnant employees don't have the right to demand a light duty assignment when you view it in the reality of the work life in a public safety agency. Fascinating decision, and I am wondering whether or not we are going to see some reaction in Congress to that decision. Well, with that, we've hit our witching hour, and it's time for me to conclude the podcast. I won't be talking to you until 2021. Really look forward to that. I hope all of you have a wonderful holiday season and that everybody stays safe out there. And with that, this is Will Aitchison signing off.